Okay, it is 9:02 on my official clock here. So, Casey, if you can mute the phones, that'd be great.
Sure.
Conference muted.
All right, good morning, everybody. It seems like it's been a while since at least I've been live. I've been accused of not being live certain times in my life, but I know, as I told you, I was away out of the country, and hopefully the pre-recorded message worked okay for those of you who participated. All right, so in addition to a little hearing that's going to begin in Congress today, some of you may have heard about that, wanted to report on a bipartisan move, an introduction of legislation in the Senate. This was by Senators Chris Murphy, he's a Democrat from Connecticut, and Todd Young, he's a Republican from Indiana. They recently introduced a bill entitled the Workforce Mobility Act. And I've talked about prior iterations of this in telebriefs, particularly last year. But this particular bill seeks to ban totally non-compete agreements outside of the sale of a business or the dissolution of a partnership, which would be a very drastic piece of legislation if it gets traction, because many of you out there do have effective non-competes with your employees, many times in the sales field. And if this bill were to be enacted, and it's a far, far distance from being enacted, it seems to me, it would be enforced by both the Department of Labor and the Federal Trade Commission. And if enacted, it would empower both of these agencies to enforce this legislation through fines, actual monetary fines on employers who either fail to notify their employees that non-competes are illegal or fail to notify that their employees that they're not required to sign non-compete agreements. So this bill has been referred to the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. Again, with everything going on in Congress, it remains to be seen whether this will gain any attention. But I do think, again, it is a sign, an indication of what I've talked about in prior telebriefs, which there is certainly a move afoot, both on the state level and on the federal level, to take a good look at non-compete agreements. And as you know, I've talked about the fact that the state of Maryland now has law on the books which would prohibit non-competes among lower paid employees. And usually that is not going to be all that useful to you anyway as an employer. But it is an indication that both on the state and federal level and in an economy where there is great emphasis placed on mobility of employees, that at some point in the future, we may have a national restriction of some sort on the enforcement or even on the entering into of non-competes between an employer and an employee. Those of you who do have non-competes out there, many of you have, that I've dealt with as clients, have asked, in addition to injunctive relief, that is a court order that would enforce a non-compete, are monetary damages available in a typical non-compete situation? Because frequently it's very hard to prove discernible damages, monetary damages for the breach of a non-compete. And those of you who have non-competes or are contemplating them may create what's called a liquidated damages clause in your non-compete. And a liquidated damages clause would simply say, excuse me, that if you violate a non-compete, a liquidated damages clause would say you're going to be liable for X amount of damages for every violation of the non-compete. So rather than proving lost profits or lost revenues, you're in a situation where a court may enforce a liquidated damages clause as long as the court views the liquidated damages clause as reasonable and not really as a penalty on the departed employee. So those of you who are contemplating entering into or creating a non-compete with your employees, be aware that liquidated damages clauses are enforceable as long as they are deemed to be reasonable and not a penalty on the employee or the departed employee. In news at the National Labor Relations Board, which we frequently see, and in this era of the Republican-controlled National Labor Relations Board, significantly, in the last couple of weeks, the NLRB overturned an administrative law judge's finding that an employer's confidentiality rule and media rule violated the National Labor Relations Act. Just to reiterate, under the Obama administration, the National Labor Relations Board, which was controlled by Democrats, essentially took a dim view of those employers who were trying to enforce social media rules that were deemed to be too restrictive, and intrusive of employees' Section 7 rights, that is, the right to engage in concerted protected activity. Now we have a whole new board. It's controlled by three Republicans as opposed to Democrats. And, of course, they promulgated essentially a new interpretive rule in 2017 under a case called Boeing, the airline, or the airline manufacturer. And under this rule, the board basically takes a common sense view and a business favorable view of those rules that are promulgated and enforced under an employee handbook, where employers basically state, number one, that if employees are posting things on social media where they are purporting to speak on behalf of the employer, that they will have violated the social media rules of that employer. And if an employee under a social media post purports to post confidential or proprietary information that would impact his or her employer, that would not be permissible under the employer's social media post either. So those of you who, are in the business of at the end of the year reviewing your social media policies or trying to create new social media policies to be enforced or communicated at the beginning of 2020, know that at least for the time being, under a Republican-controlled National Labor Relations Board, we're in a situation where the board takes a pretty business favorable view of, handbook policies and social media policies, which are grounded in common sense, which we didn't find, frankly, in the Obama-controlled National Labor Relations Board. You'll recall that there was essentially a microscopic view that the Obama administration entered into when social media policies, handbook policies were really viewed within the context of the board's very employee favorable view on protected concerted activity under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act. Right now, we have a much more employer favorable view, business favorable view. And essentially what the board says under Boeing is that you balance the impact of the handbook rule or the social media rule on whether or not it impacts the employer's ability to exercise common sense business favorable rules with whether or not in actuality, not in theory, but in actuality, it negatively impacts on an employee's right to engage in protected concerted activity. And if that balance weighs more favorably in turn of the employer as opposed to the employee, then the particular rule will be granted favorable treatment at the National Labor Relations Board, which is really not, in my view, all that controversial or all that radical a view. It simply says that you weigh these two things together, and if the balance, is much more favorably inclined towards an employer, then it passes muster. And if it doesn't, then an employer may have an issue. So as you go about reviewing your handbook policies and procedures, whether it's in the realm of the social media or confidentiality or any other employer policy, know that what you really do is you weigh and you balance whether or not it makes good business sense or whether it unreasonably intrudes on the employee's right to exercise Section 7 rights. And if you are in doubt, then you're in sort of a gray area, and I would suggest certainly at that point that you seek consultation with a labor attorney who is skilled in this area. Also at the board, very recently in a case called Seven Seas Union Square, the board applied what's likely to be applicable board law in a universal context on the issue of whether or not there is joint employer status. And again, as you'll recall, probably under the Obama administration overthrew decades of good board law in determining whether two putative employers would be deemed to be joint employers. Now we go back to a test that was used for decades, and I think which the board has sought public opinion on, and I think the case will be clear that two putative employers will be deemed to be joint employers under the National Labor Relations Act if one of those employers exercises direct and immediate control over the terms and conditions of employment of the other so-called employer. And absent direct and immediate control, they will not be found to be joint employers under the National Labor Relations Act. That, of course, is an important particular factor because if two employers are found to be joint employers under the National Labor Relations Act, then one becomes liable for representation campaigns of the other, or if the other is actively engaged in a collective bargaining agreement, the second employer would be deemed to have adopted bound by the terms and conditions of the collective bargaining agreement in force. So I do believe that in the upcoming weeks and months, we'll see clarity on this issue, and my guess is that it'll be clear that in order to be bound by a so-called dual employer theory, there will need to be a direct and immediate control over terms and conditions of employment of that second employer. I wanted to mention a case that comes out of Oklahoma, not that Oklahoma is really the bellwether of employment law throughout the country, but it signals, I think, a trend that we will likely see in the case of drug testing. So this was a case that came out of the Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals in a case called Rose versus Berry Plastics Corporation. Very recent 2019 case. Briefly, what happened was the employee Rose worked for this company, Berry Plastics, in the role of a machine operator. And while he was trying to clear an obstruction by hand from a jammed machine, a coworker of his triggered this so-called guillotine machine, crushing his hand and wrist. Well, their policy was that after any post-accident drug test, a drug test would be conducted. And lo and behold, Rose went through this drug test and it came up as positive for marijuana. He admitted smoking marijuana the night before, but he denied being impaired at the time of the accident, which occurred about 10 hours after he had allegedly smoked a joint at home. The court, the initial court, upheld the termination, but the appellate court, the Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals, rejected the lower court and rejected the underlying inference that he was intoxicated. And they cited the fact that that Rose overcame this presumption by showing up to work at 6 a.m., driving apparently safely 45 minutes to work, operating his machine without incident for the first 2 hours of his shift, showing no sign of unfitness or intoxication to his coworkers, and consequently that the employer offered no evidence of intoxication at the time of the accident. Now, I've spoken before on prior Telebreeze about the fact that at least with regard to cannabis, as opposed to other prohibited drugs, we're in an era where you get into this gray zone about whether or not an employee, simply by virtue of testing positive for cannabis, also reflects unfitness for duty. And as I've always stressed to those of you in the Telebrief and to clients as well, you really need to pay attention to those objective manifestations of unfitness for duty as opposed to simply a positive drug test for a particular substance. It's probably less problematic when you're dealing with an opioid like morphine, et cetera, heroin, cocaine. But when you're dealing with cannabis, cannabis, as you know, has a shelf life in a human body. It's longer than an hour or two. And you run into these situations where an employee who manifests absolutely no indication of being unfit for duty, but yet tests positive for cannabis, creates a problem for you. As a result, I know that I have some clients who have stopped testing for cannabis, either candidates for employment or even incumbent employees. But again, I would stress that you need to train your managers and supervisors on identifying objective manifestations of unfitness, such as slurring of words, uncoordinated movement, just behavior that is unlike the behavior typically exhibited by that employee. And I think that we will see increasing litigation throughout the country on this whole issue of whether or not a positive test for cannabis automatically disqualifies an employee either for employment or workers' compensation benefits in a situation where the employee has experienced an accident at work. The last thing that I wanted to mention was a pretty widely publicized story just about 2 weeks ago about the fact that McDonald's fired its CEO, Steve Easterbrook, after its board found that he demonstrated poor judgment by having a consensual affair with a subordinate. And it raised the entire issue that has gained traction, particularly in the aftermath of the Me Too movement, of those companies who proscribe and prohibit any kind of a consensual relationship between C-level suite employer representatives and subordinates, as opposed to consensual relationships between rank and file employees or less than C-suite executives. And those of you out there who, again, are looking at your employment policies either as an end of a year and beginning of a new year, may very well, contemplate executing a policy which would prohibit even consensual relationships between C-level executives and any other employee in your company, as well as a policy which would mandate that any employees, any co-employees that are involved even in consensual relationships would, as a matter of policy, have to disclose that in a formal way to your HR department. This is an issue that will not be going away anytime soon, particularly with all the attention that is existing in the Me Too movement and as an aftermath of the Me Too movement. And I think that as a matter of good policy and as a matter of prudent policy, at least have an internal discussion about whether you want to absolutely ban any kind of consensual relationship between a C-level executive and any other employee, because the inherent power imbalance is really the issue that occurs. And, you know, you just have to think that oftentimes these relationships, even though beginning as consensual, may not end very well, and then you're off and running into the world of workplace harassment claims. So again, if nothing else, then it's an issue certainly worth discussing internally and discussing whether or not you want to, A, have disclosure requirements among employees, even for consensual relationships, and whether you want to absolutely ban these kinds of consensual relationships between a C-level executive and any other kind of employee, whether executive or non-executive, in your organization. Okay, those are the developments for the day. Casey, can you take this off of mute?
All right. Well, you got okay, a lot going on, Howard. A lot of interesting stuff going on.
Yeah, we are off of mute. As I always do, I invite any questions or comments from anybody in this forum, or if you would prefer, in a more private forum, through my email or through my phone. So any questions, comments out there?
I was surprised, Howard, that they can't measure pot the way they do alcohol, so that if you got a certain reading, if it was above this reading, then you were intoxicated, and if it was below it, then, I mean, have you ever heard of anything like that?
Well, I know that, you know, those of you who conduct drug testing of candidates or incumbent employees may get a level that is indicated on your drug test result. The problem, though, as I said, is that it doesn't always correlate directly with a period in time in which an individual may have, you know, smoked a joint or used cannabis. And there's not a consensus of opinion about it. And because of that, there's no bright line test that I know of, which would indicate that, okay, somebody was positive for cannabis. This is the level, and that means that they must have used it an hour ago as opposed to 12 hours ago. It just has a long shelf life. And I'm not aware that there is any specificity that would correlate a particular level with a particular time by which the employee or candidate may have used it. So it is a controversial issue.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay. Well, if not, we are scheduled for the second Wednesday, which would be the day before Thanksgiving. So we will all, I guess, watch our diets on that Wednesday so that we can gorge ourselves on the next day. So in any event, have a good couple weeks, and we'll see each other figuratively the day before Thanksgiving. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Howard.
Hi, thanks.